Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught.
Well, in this series, we have been considering some of the big questions that people ask about Christianity. We've been considering the question of security, of evil, and so on. But sooner or later, the question comes, well, why should we listen to the Bible? Why should we listen to what it has to say on these kinds of issues? We can't trust the Bible. Everyone knows that, they say. After all, there are so many issues and problems. Issues to do with its authority, its relevance, its morality, its trustworthiness, its reliability. Richard Dawkins, and you'll see there the quote on your handout, he puts it like this in his book, The God Delusion. To be fair, much of the Bible is not systematically evil, but just plain weird. As you'd expect of a chaotically cobbled together anthology of disjointed documents, composed, revised, translated, distorted, and improved by hundreds of anonymous authors, editors, and copyists, unknown to us and mostly unknown to each other, spanning 9 centuries. Well, I wonder what you make of that. You might not put it quite like that, but maybe you know someone who would. Well, how do we defend the Bible against this kind of charge? Well, the answer we're going to see is in the Bible itself, in that passage that Derek read for us. But at that point, maybe you object and you say, well, we can't look at the Bible for the answer about itself, because that makes the answer, the argument, circular. If the Bible says itself that it is trustworthy, which we would expect, well, that's circular. And we live in a culture where we're very suspicious, aren't we? We're suspicious of authorities or authority figures, and you can understand why. So we're suspicious of the government, of politicians, the Iraq dirty dossier, the MP's expenses scandal. We're suspicious of the media and entertainment world, phone hacking, fake news, Weinstein. We're suspicious even of the church, the abuse inquiries. And yet, unless you're an extreme cynic or a conspiracy theorist who's decided that the best course of action is now to go and hide in a nuclear bunker somewhere in Switzerland, we do still trust somebody. We all believe, we all trust in something or someone. You've got to trust somebody. Even if all you do is trust in yourself and those who are close to you. In fact, we do this all the time, every day. You're doing it right now. You did it this morning. You got out of bed. You trusted in TFL or Southern. I don't know whether you should have done that. But we decide who we trust, and we do that every day. But the big issue is, who do we trust ultimately when it comes to ultimate things? Who is our ultimate authority? Well, we all have somebody or something that we base our lives upon. Something or someone that ultimately, when it comes down to it, we are committed to. That we have a prior commitment to. For some, it is God or Allah or whoever, or many gods. But if it's not God, then it is reason or it is experience. There is something that forms the ultimate foundation for our lives. And you cannot appeal to something higher than an ultimate authority. So of necessity, these things are always circular. Let me give you an example. Someone says, I am a follower of the Jedi religion. There are these people, they do exist. And you ask them, well, why do you trust that? Is that because you've just seen too many movies? And they say, no. It's because I had this experience of the Force. I felt it. Well, why do you believe that? Well, ultimately, they are saying that their experience is their ultimate authority. Or maybe an atheist says, I believe in science, I believe in evolution and the multiverse theory, And therefore, as a result of that, I reason that there is no need for God. Well, you ask them, why do you trust that conclusion, that step, that leap of logic that you have made? And they say, well, I applied my mind to it, my reason to it. Reason is then the ultimate authority. You see, you cannot appeal to a higher authority than an ultimate authority. And the same then goes with the Bible. Now, I'm not saying that's true, that's proof, but it is a start, because at that point we recognise that we all have trust issues. We need to ask, what authority is it that we are basing our lives upon? The question becomes, can we really trust whatever that is? Our experience, our reason, or whatever. And then we need to ask, are we sure? Are you 100% sure? Or are you sure, are you certain that the Bible isn't reliable? That it isn't trustworthy? Are you able to say that? So I'd like to encourage us to have an open mind, to look at what the Bible has to say, to test it, to look at it, and to see if it stacks up. We're going to do that now, or at least we're going to make a start. So why then should we trust the Bible? Well, the first I'll say is this: trustworthy testimony. Trustworthy testimony. Cross-examining the eyewitnesses. In your hands here, you have a copy of Luke's account of Jesus' life. Now, he was a medical doctor, and so he's educated, and he claims that what he did was cross-examine the eyewitnesses, interview the eyewitnesses. Well, let's play CSI Judea. We're on page 3 of the little white books, if you've lost the place, and take a look at chapter 1 and the first few verses there. Here are the sources. Verse 1, there are eyewitnesses. They were there and they saw what happened, as it says, among them. Verse 2, they were there at the beginning. They saw it all. Verse 2, they were ministers. Their job, what they were commissioned to do, was to record it. Record this message. Record what they saw, what happened, and pass it on. And they did that. They did exactly that. The message spread. In fact, it spread like wildfire. It went global. And it still is going global. But that's not all. Here is the method that was applied then to these sources. Verse 3. It says that it was carefully researched. It says it, he followed it closely for some time. And it's carefully ordered. It says there, verse 3, it's an orderly account. What does that mean? Well, I think it means there's a chronology, there's an order of events. It starts in Galilee with Jesus' birth. It ends in Jerusalem. It ends in his death. Real places in history as well. But I think it also means something else. That it has a theological order to it. It doesn't just tell us the events, but it tells us the meaning, the interpretation of those events. It also tells us what it is about, what we're to understand from it. It gives us a purpose in writing. And that purpose is there in verse 4. That you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. Certainty, confidence in the message, what was taught. That we can know these things. That it really happened in history. That it really does have a meaning. And the way he writes then fits with that. Dr. Luke records for us the names of places and people from history. Take a look over the page at chapter 2 and the first couple of verses. We're on page 8. Let me read for us. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria, and all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David. Do you see what it's saying? It's giving us the postcode where Jesus was born, where he lived. Nazareth, Galilee. Who was governor at the time? Quirinius. And it also starts to give us more details as we read on. We meet Jesus in a circle, men and women. The top two names in the UK in 2017 were Oliver and Mohammed for boys, and Olivia and Sophia for girls. And the academic, Richard Bagham, has looked at the same kind of thing for the first century. And here's what he's discovered as we look at the sources, as we look at that. The two most popular male and female names are Simon, for boys, as in Simon Peter, Jesus' right-hand man, and Mary, the most popular female name, another of Jesus' inner circle. Well, that fits what the biblical record shows us. Richard Bauckham's research shows us that it fits. And Luke even goes further. He doesn't just mention the inner circle. He mentions the minor people, the minor characters in this story. So as we read on in chapter 19, we meet Zacchaeus, the tax collector. We're told his job. And Simon, the Pharisee. The stuff that he doesn't really need to tell us, unless it is that these things actually happened and that he is recording history for us. C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Narnia stories, was also an Oxford professor in medieval history, and he wrote this. I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends and myths all my life. I know what they are like. I know none of them are like this. Of this text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, or else some unknown ancient writer without known predecessors or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern, novelistic, realistic narrative. Do you see what C.S. Lewis is saying? He's saying, go and read the ancient myths, the legends, the stories, the fairy tales. They don't read like this. But what Dr. Luke writes, what the New Testament writers write, is totally different. And Dr. Luke says here, in these opening verses, I did the research. In fact, all of the detail tells the story. So it's reasonable. And therefore, the scientific thing to do, the reasonable thing to do, is to go where that evidence takes us. And yet at that point, there is a problem. The problem of time. The objection comes. Okay, well, how do we know? How do we know that they wrote it down right in history? After all, there's the problem of time. Memories fade. Memories get more and more unreliable over time. Let me try and illustrate that. My uncle in Holland was an expert witness at the trial of the man accused of being the Nazi war criminal, Ivan the Terrible. And Ivan had committed terrible atrocities in an extermination camp. But the problem was whether people's memories were reliable enough to identify the accused man, John Demjanjuk, as Ivan the Terrible. Because the problem is, memories, they fade over time. Well, how do we answer that kind of problem? Well, for starters, the events of Jesus' life were so memorable. You wouldn't forget Jesus' death, and you definitely wouldn't forget his resurrection. And you wouldn't forget his teaching, so memorable that people quote it today. But especially, you wouldn't forget what Dr. Luke says. Dr. Luke says, actually, it isn't just that they wrote this down a long, long time afterwards. They wrote it down, he wrote it down, and interviewed the eyewitnesses when they were still alive. Verse 2 of chapter 1 shows us that. That's exactly what he did. Just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, they seem good to me also. And he wrote down this orderly account. He wrote it down when they were still alive so that memories couldn't fade. So there's no time problem. But also then another objection comes, another kind of time problem. Okay, well, let's say for argument's sake that he did write it down before memories could fade. How do we know that we've still got what they wrote down, what Dr. Luke wrote down? Maybe they saw it and then over time, just as Richard Dawkins says, the editors came in and they edited things and errors crept in over time. Some were innocent, some were less innocent. How do we know that we still got it, that it's reliable? Well, that's where this diagram comes in handy. You might want to turn to it and open it out if you haven't done so. And here's what this is showing. Now, I don't know whether anyone here is a Harry Potter fan. Now, the first edition of Harry Potter is worth $40,000 to $50,000. That's quite a lot, isn't it? Anyone got a copy? Well, you'll have to tell us later. Now, the problem is we don't have the first edition of the New Testament of what Luke wrote. And that is also the case for any writings of ancient literature, ancient texts. But what we do have is lots of copies. And the way to tell what the first edition said is to compare the copies. And the more copies you've got, the better, so that you can compare them and be confident when they match up that that's what the original said. And when it comes down to it, as that diagram shows very vividly, we have more copies closer in time, with a smaller gap in time, from the original for the New Testament than any other work of ancient literature, any comparable old book. Do you see what that is showing us? The New Testament documents were not lost in time. But then another objection comes. Well, what about the problem of translation? This was all 2,000 years ago, longer for the Old Testament. And the Old Testament was written in Hebrew and the New Testament was written in Greek. And what we've got here right in your hands is a translation. And we all know the problems with translation. In 1877, the Italian astronomer Giovanni Virginio Schiaparelli, someone will have to tell me if I said that right later, began mapping the planet Mars. And he thought he'd discovered channels. So he wrote down in Italian, canali, which unfortunately got translated, canals. Get out your gondola and take it to Mars. Get out your boat, Venice on Mars. Well, the US astronomer Percival Lowell was so convinced that he researched it as well and mapped many more of these canals and wrote three books on Mars with illustrations showing canals built by the Martians. Well, you can see the problem there with translation. Now, some are just embarrassing, but some are more serious. And when it comes to the Bible, the stakes are so much higher, aren't they? It is about life or death, hell and heaven, certainty or doubt. Actually, when it comes to the Bible, I think actually that the translations are an advantage rather than a problem. Look at that diagram once again. Look at that. And you'll see there on that big kind of circle, you'll see there it mentions Latin and Slavic and Armenian, Coptic, Ethiopian, Syriac and so on. Well, what is that showing us? Well, this is the advantage of those translations. Because what you can do with the translations is, again, cross-check. And if they say the same thing as those originals, well then, as those copies, should I say, well then you can be even more certain that we have it recorded accurately for us. And that was the whole point of the Reformation 500 years ago. The translators went back to the Greek and saw some of the changes that had been made in the Latin version in medieval times that were wrong, and they corrected them. The Bible wasn't so much lost in translation, it was refound when comparing the original, and we have it there for us, recorded. So, this is trustworthy testimony. But that is not all, because it's not enough just to stop here. Secondly then, our second point there on the sheets, testimony of and about Jesus Christ. Now, we need to go to the other end of Luke's Gospel, Luke's account, to see this. So turn, if you would, with me to page 79, right at the back. Page 79. And look down there to that little bit that says Jesus appears to his disciples. And I'm going to read from sentence verse 36. As they were talking about these things, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, "Peace to you." But they were startled and frightened and thought they saw a spirit. And he said to them, "Why are you troubled? And why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have. And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while they still disbelieved for joy, were marveling, he said to them, have you anything here to eat? They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it before them. Then he said to them, these are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures and said to them, thus it is written that the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. Here is the risen Jesus Christ amongst his disciples in conversation with them, and they're full of doubts, they're full of questions. And maybe that is us. But he wants to turn their doubts into certainty. That is why Luke is writing as well. And he tells them where the whole of history is going, has always been going. He tells them the facts, he gives them the evidence, and says it all points to me. The identity, the death, the resurrection of Jesus. He explains it from history, from the whole of history, and says all of it points to me, to my coming. Some people just talk about one thing, don't they? A new relationship, a car, a gadget, their football team or work or whatever it is. And that shows what matters to them. Maybe we've got something like that that we always talk about. A favourite hobby or a favourite person or something like that. But Jesus says, when it comes to God, he has only one conversation topic. And it is himself. The Bible says lots of things in lots of different styles of literature, but there is one thing that it points to. Verse 27, Jesus says, it is me. And he goes on to say there in the verses that follow that we read out, verse 44, it is about me, the prophets, and Moses, which is shorthand for the whole Bible. They all have one conversation topic. It's me, Jesus Christ. Now that is a very bold claim, isn't it? Jesus, you see, he isn't just claiming to be another person in history like Henry VIII or Einstein or Picasso or someone else. He's claiming that history is his story, that it is all about him. Verse 46, all about his identity. The Christ, God's ruler, the one who rules the world, who has the right to rule the world and is in charge. His death, his resurrection, which, verse 47, makes forgiveness possible. If we'll only seek it, if we'll only turn around and come to him, because he knows our hearts, he knows what we're like deep down, he knows it all. But the trouble is, these disciples, full of their doubts, they can't see it. They don't get it. They don't get the Old Testament. They don't get Jesus. Until, that is, verse 45, he opens their minds. So they get it. And it is the same with us. And at that point, things start to get very personal. Because certainty is not just about knowing facts in my head. It is that. But ultimately, these facts are about a person. Christianity is about knowing a person, Jesus Christ. It's about a relationship with the God of history, Jesus Christ. So in conclusion then, as we close, who do you trust? Who or what do we trust? Are they more reliable than Jesus? The one who history centres on. Can you trust them? Can you trust them when it matters most? With life, with death, with your past, with your present, with your future. Thank you very much for listening. And I'm going to hand back over to Claire now.